supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Hundreds of inmates and those on probation in Philadelphia who want a second look at their cases are stuck, waiting for an attorney to be assigned to the appeal. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Some are completing their time in jail before having their appeal heard, making questions about their punishment moot. More from WHYY's Bobby Allen.
Police had their eye on Emma Turner's Aramingo Avenue house long before November 2006, but that's when she found out about it.
Mixing potato salad, and then they bust in the door, never knocked. They pushed me into the counter. My head almost hit the cabinet door where there were two nails sticking out.
She holds up her hand, showing an indelible reminder of that day.
You see the two black dots in my hand, my palm? It came from the nails in the cabinet.
Turner, who is 52 and the mother of six, was a middle school teacher. She had no criminal history. Police say an undercover agent sold her drugs. While her then-boyfriend and son were under suspicion, she had an alibi, who says she was making Thanksgiving dinner for kids at her school when authorities claim she bought drugs. But that alibi witness never testified at trial. Turner got 2 years of probation. She filed an appeal citing the missing witness and won a new trial. She and her attorney, Elaine Brin, were elated.
I was happy. I was crying. Elaine was crying. We all was hugging and everything. It was nice. I just felt like I was really going to get relief now.
But the hearing never happened. Prosecutors asked for more time to respond. Then her probation ended. The issue went to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and the justices said since Turner's no longer on probation, she'd have a case anymore. By then, she had paid a heavy price.
I lost my home. I lost my car. I lost all my money. And 13 years of hard-earned work, everything in my house I lost.
This is a defense attorney's worst nightmare. And some of them fear it's going to happen more and more, with too many appeals and not enough resources to process them. This type of post-conviction appeal is bogging down the system. There are currently 1,500 of them pending in Philadelphia's state court system. About 750 have not yet been assigned to attorneys and judges. There are only about a dozen defense attorneys who are regularly appointed by the court to take them on.
It doesn't take much back of the envelope math to see that that's not just a temporary backlog issue. That's an unsustainable model.
Henry Sias is one of the defense attorneys who works a lot on these types of cases. He says it isn't popular work. The pay rate hasn't changed since the 90s. Most of the clients are currently incarcerated and have already filed appeals representing themselves, making their cases hard to win. And few ever get new hearings.
All of my clients are already in a bad position at the time they come to my desk. And when you get a victory, you have to let that victory sustain you for years.
This type of post-conviction appeal, according to Temple University law professor Jules Epstein, is critical to the process.
You get a new lawyer whose job it is to first read over whatever happened and see if mistakes were made that you can find on the record. And sometimes there are mistakes off the record. A lawyer didn't find the right witnesses, didn't get the right expert.
He says the mounting backlog with few attorneys willing to dive into these cases can create some troubling situations.
Well, I'm sitting in jail, and maybe everyone would agree, my God, you got too much time. But by the time we get to it, you've done the too much time. So the delay is an issue.
Some have called the backlog situation a crisis. But in his chambers, Judge Leon Tucker, who oversees the criminal division, shot down this notion.
No, not a crisis.
He says there is a big inventory of Post-Conviction Relief Act petitions. Most people call them PCRAs. But he says more lawyers need to step up.
Some people don't like to do them, but nonetheless, they have to be done. And so, therefore, a decision was made that if you're available to take any case as a court-appointed basis, then you should take the PCRA as well.
Tucker says since taking over the criminal division in March, he's identified 147 defense attorneys qualified to do these appeals, much more than the dozen or so who often appear on court-appointed lists. Several legal experts say letters sent out to attorneys asking them to take appeals clients come off as the court begging, but Tucker doesn't think so.
We're not begging anybody to do anything. We've got attorneys who have signed up to do this work and that are doing it.
David Carroll is the executive director of the National Sixth Amendment Center. He says he's examined many court systems, and this issue seems to be unique to Philadelphia.
Getting rid of this backlog, I think this problem's going to be there 4 or 5 years, even under the best of circumstances.
He says it's going to take major comprehensive reform, paying attorneys more, getting more lawyers excited about these types of cases, and dedicating more resources to recruiting and training lawyers to do this kind of technical work. Emma Turner, meanwhile, says running out the clock should not have ended her appeal.
So I feel as though you should have opportunity to fight, at least clear yourself and clear your name, and at least get that off of your record.
Since it's been hard finding full-time work as a convicted felon, Turner has just started a home renovation business and babysits on the side. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Today marks the 75th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, the act that brought the United States into World War II. More than 2,400 people were killed, 1,100 wounded that day. Stockton University in Atlantic County, New Jersey, was one of several locations in our region to mark the anniversary. Naval veteran Peter Fantacone of Mays Landing enlisted right after Pearl Harbor. He spoke about his experience helping to launch the D-Day invasion.
The explosion on our port side rocked the ship, starting a fire and spraying the forward deck with fuel oil. The crew battled the flames, then a shell from the German batteries on shore exploded aboard.
Fantacone was 17 years old when he enlisted. Now 93, he fondly remembers what it was like 4 years after Pearl Harbor when World War II ended.
Church bells rang across the United States and Canada, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from the Arctic to the Gulf Coast. Not in triumph or celebration, but as a solemn reminder of national unity.
A North Carolina man was recently arrested in D.C. after firing a gun inside a popular pizza shop. He told police he made the trip to self-investigate a conspiracy theory about then-presidential nominee Hillary Clinton, the restaurant, and child prostitution. The incident, fueled by a fake news story and stoked by social media, was particularly shocking to a Philadelphia diner owner recovering from a somewhat similar, although less violent, experience at his restaurant. WHYY's Aaron Moselle reports.
It was the morning after the stunning presidential election, and emotions were running high, especially in Mount Airy, one of the city's most liberal neighborhoods.
One of our servers unfortunately said to a customer wearing Trump hat and shoes, I'm glad you're not in my section.
Ken Weinstein owns the trolley car diner on Germantown Avenue. He says the customer stormed out shortly after the exchange, but it's what happened when she returned a week later that set off the storm. Weinstein says the customer moved towards the bathroom and then stood uncomfortably close to the server, who was working a different section of the diner.
When the server turned around to help a customer, ran into her. And she immediately, the customer started yelling and screaming that she was physically assaulted. Then she took the unnecessary and scary step of letting a friend of hers know, who was head of a group called Citizens for Trump and has 60,000 Twitter followers.
Weinstein says things accelerated from there.
Immediately, our phones started to ring to the point that I instructed our staff to stop answering the phones because the language was so scary and ugly and hateful. We had to take down our Facebook page because, again, the messages there, particularly for a family-friendly restaurant, were not appropriate.
Weinstein says the phone calls and emails have slowed to a trickle, but he remains concerned about what implications the episode has for the future, especially after reading what happened at the Comet Ping Pong Pizza Shop in D.C.
It's incredibly scary what's going on these days, that the internet and social media was something originally to be used to our advantage, and now it's being used to our detriment.
Michael Kornfield is an associate professor of political management at George Washington University. He says given the nature of social media, he wasn't particularly surprised that some Facebook posts and tweets led people to take things into their own hands.
In your business, you get assignments, and and you go out and collect information, and then you collaborate with your editors, and only then does it go out. But we don't have those gates or filters on social media. And so when there are times of tension and anxiety, which is the post-election atmosphere in the United States, these things are going to happen.
To counter that, Kornfield offers one simple solution.
We all have to learn that when we hear and see something on social media, it's raw, and we have to check, and we have to wait for other people to check before we react. We all have to learn patience. I don't know how many more of these kinds of incidents there will be before that becomes a habit.
Before someone potentially gets hurt. Back at the diner, Weinstein says the incident hasn't hurt business. If anything, it's helped. He says the customer who did not file a report with police has been back at the trolley car without incident. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
Still ahead this evening, we'll get a description of how Drexel students are making drones dance.
This is a dance. The drones want to move in a very choreographic style. It's not just a matter of, oh, go from there to there.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. We are mired in the season of giving, not just gifts for family and friends, but also to nonprofits and charities. Let's speak with Katharina Rosqueta, founding executive director of the Center for High Impact Philanthropy and adjunct faculty of the School of Social Policy and Practice at the University of Pennsylvania. Kat Rosqueta, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Great to be here.
And let's talk about what is now the sixth edition of CHIP's High Impact Giving Guide. Who is your team at Penn, and how do they go about researching and coming to decision points?
I'm lucky enough to lead a multidisciplinary team. So we have folks who have trained in as doctors, in nonprofit leadership, in public policy. And this team and students and faculty spend all year trying to understand which nonprofit models and philanthropic approaches are most effective in addressing all the things that donors want to make a difference in.
So how is the work CHIP similar to and differentiated from other groups that might come to mind, say Charity Navigator?
Mm-hmm. So Charity Navigator and GuideStar, which are two nonprofit organizations that our team has been advisors to and served on boards of, they provide a whole host of information on nonprofit organizations, focused mostly on things like their finances that they pull from tax returns. Sometimes they'll describe the program so you can have a sense of what kind of work these nonprofits do. What our center does is look at the kind of good things donors want to make happen. And so that could be reducing hunger in our community, or it could be making sure that the homeless are cared for, or that children who aren't reading can read by grade level. Then we'll look at how can you take the money that you have and make it go the farthest. And then we'll look at what kinds of organizations can do that. And so we're really focused not on the financial information, although we consider it for bang for the buck. We're really focused on what's the impact these organizations have so that it can line up with the impact that donors want to see with their funds.
Is the guide primarily intended for those with deeper pockets, or those of any means can avail themselves of it and make meaningful contributions?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned like how much money you need to have in order to take advantage of the opportunities in the guide. You can make a huge difference with $2. $2 can protect a child in the developing world from known, treatable, deadly diseases.
But factored into that $2 is the implication that $1.80 of it won't go to administrative costs.
Well, it's interesting. A lot of the reason why people look at overhead ratios is because for many, many years, that was the only type of information you could get about nonprofits. It wasn't the best kind of information. It was literally the only thing you could get. What you really want to understand is, what do you get for that cost? So the result is not money going to programs. The result is a kid can read. The result is a kid's alive. The result is this family has food. And if the best way to make sure that child can read that family has food is to make sure you have an information system that gets the food right to where it's needed, or make sure that you have professional staff so that you can take advantage of all the volunteer help. That would normally go into overhead ratios. And I'd say, but do you have more impact? I'll give you an example. When I said $2 to protect a child, in that case, this was a campaign to vaccinate against measles. Some people will say, well, how much is the medicine? I'll pay for the medicine. But if you just pay for the medicine, it's not going to help the child, because what you have to pay for is the transportation and the community health worker that makes sure that child gets vaccinated.
It's interesting. You give a seal of approval, as it were, to 11 different philanthropies, and in turn, you've received a seal of approval from Fidelity Charitables. Describe that affiliation.
Yeah, so these donor-advised fund accounts have grown so much so that Fidelity Charitable is second to the Gates Foundation in the amount of money that it donates through these accounts each year. And one of the ways that our team has worked to make sure that our guidance is available to donors when they need it is through an arrangement with Fidelity where they took all the content from our guide, they sent messages to their 100,000 account holders, and they took our guidance and mirrored it on their site. And then hopefully they're off and running and choosing some of the opportunities that we've done the hard work of researching so that the account holders can get to impact faster.
Kat, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Kat Ruscetta, founding executive director of the Center for High Impact Philanthropy and adjunct faculty of the School of Social Policy and Practice at the University of Pennsylvania. You can hear much more of our conversation at newsworks.org. A New York dance company has choreographed a fleet of robotic flying drones to interact with its human dancers. The performance premieres in Philadelphia tonight. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that the drones were designed by Drexel University students.
This is no ordinary drone taking off inside a theater. It was engineered from scratch by students at Drexel University to fly like a dancer. That means the drones are lighter and quicker, says Professor Youngmoo Kim of Drexel's Excite Center.
This is a dance. The drones want to move in a very choreographic style. It's not just a matter of, go from there to there, right? There has to be a certain style to that.
The drones dance with human partners, choreographed by David Parsons. He said it's more than a technological gimmick. He wanted to create a compact dance, it's only 8 minutes long, that reflects the quickly accelerating relationship between humans and machines.
You know, the spine, it took 6 million years to get that spine erect. After that, all of a sudden you're dancing with these drones. So you're in real time, man. You're dancing with robotics. It's an evolution of man and machine.
Parsons says he had this idea a few years ago, but then the technology was not advanced enough to work. Now, engineers at Drexel University can project a field of infrared light across the stage. That's a web of invisible light that allows a computer to track the drones through three-dimensional space in real time. That makes their movements far more precise. It's how Parsons can subtly manipulate their movements to bring the drones into relationships with humans, even have those movements express personality, like hesitation or affection or aggression.
Some of the relationships are going to be quite difficult between man and machine. There's going to be beautiful relationships between us and machines. We already know. What would we do without our cell phones? But there's going to be other relationships that are not.
The Parsons Dance Company performs the drone dance this week at the Prince Theater in Philadelphia. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
An unruly British Christmastime type of show called a panto first showed up some 300 years ago. It's still popular today throughout the United Kingdom. Pantos are just catching on in the United States, but a People's Light and Theater Company in Malvern, they've been a holiday staple for more than a decade. People's Light is arguably the nation's major creator and producer of pantos, and this year's is Sleeping Beauty. WHYY Theater blogger Howard Shapiro offers this review.
How do you make a panto? Take a fairy tale and twist and pummel the plot. Give it at least one talking animal character, a villain, and a man playing an altogether over-the-top lady. Write a chase scene. Have the cast grovel throughout for audience response, and in the case of People's Light, make it a full-blown, brand-new musical. If this sounds like a recipe for goofiness, it's supposed to be. Sleeping Beauty, the company's newest panto, has all the trimmings and more. It's among the best I've seen. It does what quality pantos do by pleasing the kids on one level and the adults on another. It offers especially fine songs by local theater artist Alex Bechtel, and its spirited cast has as good a time as the audience. People's Light artists Pete Pryor and Samantha Redding wrote this Sleeping Beauty set in a town called Paoli Shoals. The place's claim to fame was the LP records it produced, but 16 years ago, record players were banned after one of its singing stars put a curse on the newborn princess. If she sticks herself on a needle, in this case a record needle, before her 16th birthday, she'll sleep 100 years. In this robust version, the moon somehow falls into Paoli Shoals and has to get back into the sky, a tricky subplot that offers some of the show's funniest moments. And here, I have to mention Mark Lazar of People's Light. He's always the guy playing the woman in the stage company's pantos, and he can say more with a few well-timed flicks of false eyelashes than other actors can with lines. So here's a way to spot the season's Grinches, Scrooges, and assorted party poopers. They'd be the ones not smiling at the panto of Sleeping Beauty. It runs through January 15th at People's Light in Malvern. For WHYY, I'm Howard Shapiro.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.